All right. Hi, I'm Corey Rausch, and you're listening to the EdTech podcast, Kano Takeover.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the EdTech podcast. Today, I'm delighted to have Corey Rausch, who is literacy specialist at Muskingum County Library System in Ohio. So hello, Corey.
Hello, good morning.
And what time is it with you there as well?
I was just about ready to say it's about 8 o'clock in the morning here, but I guess that's a little bit later in the day for you. So
it is indeed. So we're just coming up to 1 p.m. in the afternoon. But have you been up long or?
I have not been up long, but I've got my coffee, so hopefully. Hopefully I'm on point.
So I suppose today what we're really going to do is investigate what you're up to at the library system where you work. And but before we delve into that, I wanted to find out a little bit about you. So if I understand correctly, you previously worked across schools, adult education and libraries. Is that right?
Yes, my background is, my certification is in elementary education, and I spent 2 years teaching at kind of an alternative school. It started as a dropout recovery program and then kind of expanded to be a, over here in Ohio, we have things called community schools that are just kind of different variations of charter schools and things. And I worked with a an elementary program then called Foxfire Schools. I taught there for 2 years, and then I started working with the library in 2014.
Okay.
And sort of what I do with the library is be a liaison between the library system and teachers in our community. So I kind of have one foot in the classroom and one foot out of the classroom working with the library.
Well, that's quite interesting as well in terms of, having worked across all those sort of different spaces, I suppose, for education. How do you see the experience differing within, say, the bounds of the school environment or libraries, and what were kind of contrasting experiences you had there?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you the main thing that I've learned just in working with the library particularly, but knowing my experience in the schools and is just how we think that kids spend a lot of their time in school. It's easy to kind of think that, those 6 or 7 hours or so that they're spending in school adds up to be a lot, but really they're spending a huge amount of their time outside of school. And, of course there's some sleeping hours in there every once in a while. And, but there's also a lot of time spent, hopefully at home with families or out in the community doing things with their family. But certainly that's kind of the ideal situation. And in a lot of chances, in a lot of cases, there are, there's just a lot of idle time, where the library for a lot of our patrons becomes kind of a community center of sorts.
Okay.
And so I've really kind of found that there's a lot of potential to harness that time and that, we don't want it to just be 2 more hours of school at the end of the day. But at the same time, how can it be not just a warm building that you're hanging out in, but also a place where you want to go and that there is something beneficial to you at the library. So
that's very interesting because something special is happening because it's not this formal environment of education, but at the same time, there's this huge access to knowledge and perhaps an environment that people feel comfortable in as well.
Yeah. And I mean, when I was growing up, the library was very much the public library was very much a place where it was almost like a free bookstore.
Yeah.
And then in recent years, libraries have really had to struggle with the fact that access to books is not the hurdle anymore.
Mm.
Certainly if you want to find books and you want to get access to books, there are sources for that. Libraries have really had to struggle with, okay, then what is our role in kind of a post, in an ebook society or something? Ebooks certainly aren't the only reason that that's changed. You know, Google has really taken a lot of the that whole information gathering aspect of libraries has kind of made that less of an impact. And so libraries are really trying to figure out, okay, then what is our role? Certainly, we're not just going to board up the windows and call it quits. But you know, what can we provide? And certainly that's been one of the things that I've been pretty involved in with the library is figuring out, you know, if students aren't coming to the library nearly as much as they used to, where can we go to find them and what can we bring to them that they need, even if they don't know that they need it?
And I think, you know, I think there's huge value in doing that. And I think, you know, here in the UK, there's the same kind of pressures, and it would be so sad to see libraries closing or not in existence, because there is something quite special about having that. It's almost like a retreat sometimes from the, especially if you live in an urban environment as well.
Certainly.
Whichever environment, but just to be able to go somewhere quietly and as a sort of thinking space as well. In terms of your particular focus, I had a little look about educreators and your specialism, I suppose. And would it be right to think that's around literacy and encouraging people to get involved with reading and also the creative side of that as well?
Certainly. You know, it's kind of one of those things where it sounds very cliche, but especially in a society where we're very much focused on you know, standardized testing and you know, reaching benchmark scores and
yep.
and you know, being at grade level, things like that, you know, I really do find that the most beneficial learning, the most beneficial knowledge is the kind that you seek out for yourself. And when you have a reason to learn, when you have you know, a goal in mind, and the learning is just kind of the steps on the way to the goal, you know, that's the kind of stuff that sticks with you for life. Certainly, you might be really good at cramming dates and historical names mm-hmm. and places into your head in order to you know, get a good grade on a single test, but kind of the things that you remember 5, 6, 7 years later are the things that you had a very clear reason for learning, and you know, a reason for seeking out the knowledge that you needed in order to become a better expert at that particular skill or something. So
more project-based learning and.
Definitely.
Yeah. I know in June that you took part with Kano with regards to a workshop to sort of work with both students and their parents. And obviously from the old model of libraries and reading, this is, you know, quite different. So could you tell us a little bit about that and, you know, how that fits in with how you see the library system working with sort of the local community and schools?
Sure. Last fall, in kind of preparing for 2016, I was trying to find some different resources and things for programming, and I just kind of stumbled upon Kano, truly, and saw the kits and thought, oh, okay, well, you know, this would be kind of neat. Basically, I attended South by Southwest, the education portion, back in March, and just kind of by happenstance, as it happens at these conferences and things, ran into some people from Kano, and we got talking about Kano. And at the time, the thing that I was probably the most impressed with, we had already received our Kano kits by the time in March where I ran into them. And so I'd already gotten a chance to kind of open up the kit, take a look at the pieces. The thing that I was the most impressed with and still am is just the instruction manual. And if you haven't had a chance to see kind of the instruction manual that comes with one of the Kano kits, it is a work of art, and quite frankly, from my background in education, also just a perfect instructional guide. It's exactly what the students need. It's exactly what draws them in and engages them. You know, it's very creative and colorful, and the artwork is great, but it just gives you just enough information to say, all right, I know how to proceed, but it's not, you know, kind of, I don't know if this reference should track, but it, you know, it's not like an IKEA furniture.
Do you know what? That was my next question. How does it rate versus the IKEA manual?
I mean, certainly in terms of simplicity, I'd say they're probably on the same level. But I guess what I would give the Kano guide credit for is that it doesn't hold your hand through the process. It just gives you just enough information so that you're not sitting there going, I have no clue where to go next. You know, so there's still room for exploring and kind of working to figure out what you need to do next. And I kind of gushed over that instruction manual for probably 5 or 10 minutes.
Quite remarkable. I feel like, you know, I was going to ask you, and we'll get onto it later on, but, you know, which are your favorite reads? But perhaps the instruction manual is up there.
Well, in education, sometimes it's the details that count. Something like that, especially because, and I guess to get back to the question, I knew that when we did our workshop with Kano, I wanted it to be very much in the hands of the kids. And so that instruction manual being the way that it was set up, I trusted that I wouldn't need to hover and kind of be on hand to read sections of it or to clarify different things. That I trusted that it would give the kids the guidance that they needed, and then be able to move on from there. But to get back to what you were saying there, as far as setting up this workshop, once we had the kids in hand and once I had talked to Kano at South by Southwest, I knew that I didn't want to just have a workshop where a bunch of kids sat around and we opened up the box and took out all the pieces, put them together, and then said, all right, goodbye. I really wanted kind of the focus to be on the significance of being able to build a computer right there that morning out of a box with no real prior experience needed. You saw on the blog post that I kind of included there, it didn't happen this way by some grand scheme, but kind of the figurehead for the workshop definitely became Ada Lovelace.
Yeah, because, I saw that. So that's great.
Yeah, and I guess kind of she just kind of embodied that spirit of, you know, she was discovering uncharted territory, and certainly had her own reasons why uncharted territory was a significant thing at that time. But what I really wanted that workshop to be focused on was, why do we have computers? Why do we need computers? What do computers allow us to do? And kind of charting the course of computers and programming over time. We showed kind of a quick little PowerPoint at the beginning where I really delighted in this part because, there are just so many comical pictures of computers throughout time.
Yeah.
The thinking machine, the analytical engine already kind of looks, of all the pictures of computers over time, it looks kind of the least funny. But certainly there were some things during, the Cold War and during World War II where, these computers filled up entire rooms. One of the pictures that I showed, I liked telling kids that at the time it was billed as the first portable computer. You know, you were supposed to be able to take this anywhere you wanted. And it was probably the size of, an industrial sized coffee machine. It certainly was not a thing you were going to toss into your backpack on the way
and what did the kids think
out the door.
That?
You know, it's really one of those things where I think I could already see the gears in their head kind of turning and thinking, well, wait a second. Like, I know what my, you know, my mom and dad's computer looks like, and I know what my teacher uses at school. What are we going to be making this morning? That, you know, they're looking around the room, seeing that we don't have walls filled with mainframes and things. That certainly the kind of computer that they were going to be making must be at least small enough to fit into those little boxes. And certainly then the question was, all right, then how powerful are these things? What are they going to actually be able to do once we've got them constructed? And so I could see the gears turning in their heads at that point.
So actually bringing the children into that workshop, how did you go about reaching out and, you know, finding children to be involved? And, you know, was it at the weekend or was it in the week, in terms of, did they come with their parents or was it with teachers and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly kind of the library has a built-in community. Certainly we have just our patron database, basically, but also we have, you know, a pretty widespread newsletter that we send out in paper and digital form each month, kind of detailing all of the different activities that we have going on throughout the library system. We have 6 branches that are throughout Muskingum County, so it's kind of a widespread area, or at least certainly very different areas. And so that was kind of the primary way that we advertised it. And we had a date in mind where the registration was going to open up, and we had the ability to kind of sign up for you know, advance notice of the registration opening up. And actually, I'm quite proud of this, but we opened up registration, I want to say around noon on a Friday. And by 2 or 3 o'clock, we had filled all the available slots that we had.
Wow.
And then had a waiting list of, I want to say, 30 to 40 kids. From there, it was just kind of a steady trickle of people finding out about it and wanting to be a part of it. And certainly, you know, a lot of the programming that we do at the library, we're not as focused on kind of that reaching that limit, because for a lot of things, there is no limit other than maybe space. In this case, the Kano workshop was a little bit different because we only had a select number of kits. And in talking with Joanna and Rebecca at Kano, I knew that I didn't want to have 5 or 6 kids gathered around one Kano kit, you know, that I wanted it to kind of be more of an intimate experience, 1 or 2 kids kind of partnered together to put something together. So we had the registration capped at a certain amount. We hit that cap very quickly. And I can also kind of proudly say, or at least Ada Lovelace would be proud for me to say, that at least half of the kids registered were girls. And that was certainly not, you know, there wasn't any plotting behind the scenes when we came up with this workshop. You know, we're going to only have boys, or we're going to have just mm-hmm. girls. But it was one of those things where I guess based on probably some version of a generalization, I just assumed that where we would see registration fall was, you know, more towards the 7 or 8 year old boys, you know, seeing, all right, computers. And, you know, one of the things we were able to kind of advertise with Kano that it would be capable of doing was, you know, Minecraft. And certainly there are girls, obviously, because we met them that day, who
yeah.
are just as interested in all of these things. And so it was really neat to be able to look at the registration list afterwards and say, oh yeah, you know, it almost fell just about 50-50, just as it should.
And what was the age range of the kids involved?
Yeah, we decided to keep it kind of that lower elementary level. So I think we said 8 years old to, I want to say, 12 or 13. You know, and that was certainly kind of one of those things we had to think of was, all right, what is too young for this workshop. And certainly, if you know the history of Kano, it was kind of born out of the idea of a six-year-old. So certainly a six-year-old is capable of putting together the kit. The question we had to ask was, you know, in this context, would a six-year-old be capable of getting kind of the full benefit of Kano and also our, you know, the programming we added on top of it? And so we just kind of focused on like 8 years and up, just knowing that there was some reading ability that was required, but also just we didn't want, you know, an eight-year-old to sit down next to an 17-year-old and feel kind of intimidated by that, or vice versa. So we kind of tried to keep it between 8 and 13.
It kind of maxed out really quickly. What would you put that down to?
Truthfully, probably just the fact that for our library system, it was a very unique experience. A lot of, and certainly I'm not, you know, denigrating any of it, but a lot of our programming generally is kind of consumption based. It's, you know, we pay to have the children's theater come in and they do a show and you sit down in the seat and you watch the show and then you leave. Or, you know, we have, you know, storytellers come in and we tell the story and you sit in the seat and you watch and you kind of play along and then you leave. There just haven't been as many opportunities at the library in recent years to kind of take such a front seat role, I should say. And this, in all of the marketing that we did for this leading up to it, you know, we really focused on the fact that an 8-year-old was going to be able to come here, build a computer, learn how to use that computer. And have, you know, in this particular case, they weren't taking the computer home, but they certainly knew that it was going to live at the library and was going to be something that would kind of, you know, they'd be leaving a little bit of a legacy in a way. So I think for a lot of our patrons at the library, this kind of showed that is a thing that they want, is to not just show up and be read to or see a show, but they want to actively participate. They want to be kind of an active participant in not only their learning, but also in the growth and development of the library.
And so, the creative aspect of it. But in terms of what you then did once you've got all the kids there and, you know, you're negotiating 8 years to 12 years old. And what did you go about actually creating when you had everyone kind of once they'd built their computers?
Yeah, and that was kind of the thing that I learned pretty quickly. And I guess the advice that I would give to anyone who is thinking about doing one of these workshops themselves is to allow for plenty of time to do this. I think we had allotted 2 hours maybe. And I spent probably the first 35 to 40 minutes, you know, reading the Ada Lovelace book and kind of just kind of doing a, you know, more of a whole group teacher led instruction. And before we actually split up into the pairs to work on the kits. And it was difficult for me ahead of time to know just how much time the kids were going to need to put together the kits. I had certainly already gotten one out and put it together myself. And I'd like to think that I probably did that, you know, probably at about the same rate as a kid would, maybe a little bit faster. Certainly I had the enthusiasm that was necessary to get it done pretty quickly. But I really didn't know how much time they would need. And the kind of the interesting thing that I found was that students needed more time to build the kits and get the kits running than I thought they would. And it wasn't that wasn't a result of anything that the instruction manual or the pieces or the assembly, you know, that wasn't the reason for it. The reason really was for a lot of these kids, it was the first time they had met They, you know, they didn't come in. Some of the kids came in with a partner or a friend or something that they, you know, wanted to work with. But for the majority of our students, they were kind of coming in on their own, and probably expected to sit down with mom or dad and work with this kit. And kind of what we challenged them to do was work with someone they'd never met before. And for an 8-year-old, especially just kind of in our current education climate, collaboration, even though it's probably one of the most important skills that we can teach kids, is just not a strong suit for a lot of kids. You know, for a lot of adults, collaboration is still a struggle. And so, you know, we didn't have any fist fights or arguments, but we had a lot of kind of that frustrated, okay, I need to figure out how to verbalize, with these other kids that are, you know, my age, some just a little bit older, and figure out how to work together. And certainly I wouldn't go back and do anything to change that. I wouldn't go back and say, well, you know, that took longer, so what we'll do is, you know, kids won't work in pairs, or, you know, kids will be required to work with someone they already know and love and work well with.
That's part of the interesting process, is actually exploring that, where the tensions are, and seeing if next time, you know, would that change how a child works with someone else. And
definitely. And I wouldn't take that away from it. You know, I would just add more time to it. And so that was the that was where I guess I was going with that, was that it took longer to do that portion. The kids that attended our first workshop, unfortunately, didn't have nearly as much time to play around with Kano once it was up and operational. There were some students that were able to stick around past the 2 hours and start working with it. A thing that we did then to kind of help with that was about a week or two later, I can't quite remember the timeline, but we had at the library, we'd already planned this at the library, but we decided to add Kano into it. We had a just kind of a freeform game day where kids could come in and they could play with Legos and they could play board games, do arts and crafts. We had a live action board game on the auditorium of the library.
Like a huge amount of fun.
Yes. And it was a pretty popular event, but we also then brought in the Kanos. And so we had, you know, Minecraft up on the Kanos, and we had the different make apps. So a lot of the kids that attended our Kano workshop were then invited to come back about a week or two later and not only get a chance to play with the Kanos themselves, but kind of, and this was, you know, a pretty heartwarming experience for me, they also got to sit there by their Kano and tell some of the kids that attended the game day program, I made this. You know, you think this is really fun to play with. I just want you to know, I put that together. I built that. And
how were the children when they got the chance to do that? Did they relish in it, or?
Well, they certainly did. They certainly did. And I give them, I give them full credit for doing that, because, you know, that is a big thing when you're that age, when you're 8 years old, there aren't a lot of opportunities to say, you know, I built this, and I'm probably going to butcher the quote. I'll just paraphrase it, but I believe it was, Steve Jobs kind of said that one of the things he really attributed to his success was from an early point in his life, you know, he had a very healthy sense of, the world around me can be changed. You know, the world around me is not static. It's not, things aren't just the way that they are. You know, everything around me was created by someone, which means it can be, you know, changed by someone also. And so, you know, kudos to these kids for being able to sit there and say, you know, that computer you're playing Minecraft on didn't just appear, you know, out of the sky. The library didn't go to Walmart and buy 10 of them. And, you know, that was, you know, they were built in the back room of Walmart or something like a kid might believe. But they, you know, they were built and constructed not only by the folks at Kano who put the pieces together and put the kit together, but also then, you know, the kids actually assembling the Kanos themselves. You know, I really enjoyed that they were given that opportunity to share that success.
No, it's amazing. One question I have was, well, there's a couple of things, but one of them was about whether we were talking earlier about the shifting role of libraries and whether there's any need sometimes to sort of educate some of the stakeholders in that library system. So whether it's existing staff or perhaps people who have enjoyed that library service and how it's changing. So, for example, explaining why there's sort of coding related activities or is it has it already evolved to a point where people understand that, you know, benefit and the role of that process beyond specifically computing. So it'd be interesting to know, because you're kind of in the middle there and because you have that element as a literacy specialist as well, how much you have to bring people with you on this journey or how that's already embedded in, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of the actual key is, you know, I consider myself a pretty, you know, I guess a pretty techie person. You know, tech has always been a thing that I've been interested in and I played around with, and I've always had the freedom and flexibility. But certainly kind of I feel rather progressive, you know, with my views on education and things. So I have to then also remind myself that, you know, the position that I'm in at the library is to design programming for our patrons, not for myself, certainly, and not for only the ideal patron also, but the patrons where they are and where we want them to be. You know, kind of our the place where I get to impact and use my own kind of views on things is that last question of where do we want patrons to be? You know, I can't change where they are when they come to us, but I can kind of impact where they might go after they leave a library program or something. And certainly in our area, I would say we're still in that kind of time frame where people certainly know that technology and being proficient in technology is important, but it's not the highest priority of, and again, you can only generalize, but you know, it's not the highest priority of the community, as a whole. And that's just kind of that's not a thing that, you know, I'm passing any judgment on. It's just a thing you have to be aware of when you're designing something like this is, you know, I guess to illustrate my point, you know, maker spaces are huge right now, obviously, and it wouldn't be responsible for us as the current library that we are to spend thousands and thousands of dollars of library funding on creating a huge, you know, 3D printer fabrication lab, you know, because, you know, that sounds great.
Printer Corey Roosh.
There we go.
Put him at the front of the library.
There we go. Yeah. You know, that would be fun to have. And that would be something that, you know, I'd like to imagine that at some point in the future, the library would have, but it wouldn't be responsible to do all of that right now because we don't have patrons who are asking for that. We don't have patrons who are looking for those kinds of things just quite yet. There are certainly communities that do, and those communities are justified in investing in those areas. Mm-hmm. We're certainly kind of in that same phase where it's like, okay, we all understand and agree that technology is important, and now what is our place in that? And so to get back to the question, I guess there was some definite resistance to the idea, definitely internally at the library, not because they didn't see it as, not because other library staff didn't see it as important, but they had some skepticism as to the free form nature of the workshop. You know, really you're just going to have kids just kind of open up a box and at the end of the 2 hours, a computer is going to be sitting in front of them. And some of that is just not having the knowledge of what Kano is, and that truly is what they've invested their time and money into, is making that a possibility. But also just kind of pointing to, you know, what I said earlier, as far as library programming being very focused on consuming experiences, and you know, that's kind of been the for a long time, that's what libraries have been known for, is, okay, I go there and I have a question. I have some random obscure question about something that happened in 1983, and I go to the library and they're going to find me, you know, five books that help me get to my answer. And in the age of Google, that's just not necessary anymore. And what's kind of interesting is that the history of libraries, public libraries in general, if you really look at some of the first public libraries that existed, you know, they existed at a time where books were not cheap to print. And so therefore, you ask yourself the question, well, so wait, you know, these libraries were filled with books and books and books. No, they weren't filled with books. They were basically just open learning spaces. You know, they had maybe a few books sitting around because that was kind of, you know, necessary for whatever purposes the library served at that time. But they were mostly open learning spaces, you know, places for collaboration, places for craftsmen and tradespeople to kind of come in and you know, work and kind
exchange
of teach
knowledge and
we
had an interview with the head of user experience at Loughborough University here in the UK, and he was talking about exactly that. So
universities are very similar too. Mm-hmm. You know, now we think of them as places where you go and you sit in a lecture and you kind of you leave with knowledge, kind of, you know, that model of I opened up my head and knowledge poured in. That's how we think of colleges and libraries now, but they both kind of started as places where, you know, it was much more that open exchange of ideas, like you said.
And in terms of the library, so I'm guessing that's state funded.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any kind of allocation of that towards specific areas? So, for example, computing or coding, or is it, you know, determined at a much broader level?
Well, I'd like to be able to kind of speak, directly to some of that, but I truthfully don't know. Mm. Kind of. I can say that Ohio is actually one of, there are certainly a lot of things that Ohio leads in. There are certainly some things that Ohio falls kind of low on the list of. One of the things that Ohio, I am proud to say, is that Ohio has always kind of invested in the state's public library system. And in recent times, when they've had the opportunity to cut a lot of that funding, it's survived. And I know that our library kind of has a lot of flexibility in where we allocate a lot of that money. I'm sure there are, you know, specific rules and regulations as to how it's allocated. But I know that our board of trustees, I met with them prior to the Kano workshop, and kind of the overwhelming consensus after I showed the board members the kit and kind of described what the kids were going to be able to accomplish at the workshop, the kind of overwhelming consensus among the board was, oh, right, this is a place where we need to spend some money in, and not just throw money at, you know, that area, because certainly one of the things, and I'm sure, anyone listening to the EdTech podcast knows, the opportunities to spend money on EdTech are plentiful.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't quite, call them infinite, but they're reaching infinity. And so you have to be then very careful about where you spend that. And Kano, I'm pretty sure that we'll be going back to Kano and investing with them to certainly with their new Kickstarter campaigns. You know, they've got new products coming, and I've already been in meetings with my people at the library and talks to see, you know, okay, how can these new products be kind of implemented into our current programming and things. But also just, I think where the board sees a lot of potential and sees some benefit in investing is in the kind of technology that focuses on that creativity aspect, giving patrons of the library a reason to come to the library and to leave with, whether it's an actual physical product or to leave with a new skill or a new technique, that's going to be where a lot of our money is spent in the coming years. I'd like to say that I don't hold the purse strings, so to speak, but I feel like I've at least done my part to show that, to highlight that that need, that necessity there. So,
and do you have sort of specific criteria that you're judged upon in terms of, I don't know, whether it's school readiness or employability if people are going back into the workplace, or is it seen as a broader facility for the community? I didn't know if it's, you know, obviously within schools and universities, it's
certainly
benchmarked in those ways.
Again, I'm not as familiar with what is kind of required of us. I know that a real benefit to kind of charting an uncharted course is that you kind of get to make up a lot of that on your own. I can, you know, kind of speak very specifically, you know, the Kano workshop that we had, I wasn't held to some unattainable standard to, you know, to make sure that when kids left there after 2 hours that, you know, they met these six criteria. I guess we're definitely, it definitely seems as if the library right now is kind of operating from that standpoint of let's try a lot of things, figure out what works, and kind of going back to that point, you can't design library programming only for your ideal patron. Certainly you can sit around and wish that the patrons of the library would act a certain way or think a certain way, or, wish for a certain, hypothetical demographic, but you have to just understand where patrons of the library start and where you want them to finish, and then kind of figure out what things along the way will get them to that finish line. And so we're able to make up, we're able to make a lot of that, those decisions kind of on our own and say, all right, what is important to us? And certainly some of the things that you highlighted are at the top of our list, employability, school readiness, things like that. Those are all criteria that we're thinking of when we make those decisions. We're just kind of in a way, I'll be kind of candid, we're fortunate that we're not sitting around having to meet kind of quantifiable goals in those areas just quite yet. I'm sure probably it won't be long before those things, you know, someone does come in and say, all right, now, you know, a successful program will result in blank number
I
of
hope that wouldn't be my fault for introducing the question. I'd feel dreadful.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and play
Yeah.
this as a reminder. Now,
I'll be
there, you know,
chased off of Twitter.
I'm not so radical as to believe that that kind of thing would doom us in any way. But I'm enjoying that right now we have a lot of freedom and flexibility in that area.
Well, and it goes back to the point at the beginning that there needs to be, or there is currently enjoyed, a difference between the school environment and what you do at the library, and that can be an opportunity to embrace different people and kind of get them introduced to different experiences as well.
Well, and a thing that fortunately we haven't our library hasn't had to deal with this in recent years, but certainly within the last decade or so, is every once in a while you do have to go back to kind of the taxpayers of the county and say, all right, we if we have we we call them tax levies here. I'm not sure, how that kind of tracks across the globe, but every once in a while you have to go back and ask the taxpayers for either more money or to kind of continue spending the same tax money in certain areas. And so, every once in a while we are held to a very tangible level of accountability, which is kind of, at that time. During that election season, you kind of have to prove that the library is doing all of the things that it kind of promised. And certainly one of the things we've found during those times is that there are varying opinions as to what the library's function and role is. And for a lot of people, that role is supposed to be, I pay my tax money and I expect to see books on the shelves and computers, at the study carrels, and that's what they think the library should look like. And then you also have then, your demographic that really focuses on what services, what new and unique experiences can I get from the library? And you need kind of a mix of both, obviously. The library certainly wouldn't be as nice to walk into if all of the shelves were bare and, all you heard was just the clicking and clacking of keyboards. At the same time, it doesn't need to be kind of that stale, musty,
Yeah, damp
you walk
pages.
in, everyone be completely silent, and it doesn't need to be that way either. Kind of a nice mix of both would be perfect.
Interesting. And what I thought was really interesting is your kind of, not frugal, but the way of embracing Karno in terms of, okay, let's have this amount of kit and let's try these workshops. Obviously has helped with the buy-in of support as well. But so you obviously mentioned that you retain those kits. So do you do those workshops every couple of months, or what do you do with the kits now that you've kind of started that process, and what's kind of next for you with regards to them?
Well, the plan is definitely to do kind of recurring workshops. I can I'll admit it. I'll admit that the start of the school year has kind of, pulled me in a few different directions, and so we haven't had a follow-up to the Kano workshop in June just quite yet. I certainly by the end of 2016, I think we'll have brought back some of those kids that participated in our first Kano workshop. I would really like to have kind of a workshop that focused more on, what Kano allows them to do as far as programming and using some of the Make apps and things like that, specifically. I'm sure we will have another workshop kind of that follows in the same format of assembling the computers for the first time and talking about, the history of computing, and going back to, there are new products coming down the line from Kano, that I'm sure we will be looking at using, and I actually have a proposal for next year's budget to experiment a little bit with the Sphero products. I'm sure you're familiar with the
Yeah,
the Sphero, and they have, I think they call it the Sphero Spark is the newest product they have, which, you know, really focuses on, okay, not only do I have this cute little thing that rolls around and, you know, lights up, but what can I actually do to, you know, program it and make it a functional device. So I'm hoping that, in 2017, we'll have, some newer areas, some newer products to kind of experiment with. A lot of kind of the name of the game for me at the library has been doing a lot of these small kind of pilot projects, really seeing, especially with something like this, where, you know, certainly the Kano kits are, you know, they're kind of, depending on how much money you have available to you, they're either relatively cheap or they're relatively expensive. And so, you know, if I had went in and said, you know, we're going to buy 100 of these and hope that 100 kids show up, you know, I probably would have not gotten that approved. So, you know, we had to kind of start small and kind of prove that the interest and the enthusiasm was there. Yep. So that's why, going back to saying, you know, we had 30 or 40 kids on the waiting list. Now I have tangible results that I can go back to the board and say, all right, you know, there actually are 50 people that, you know, have already designated that they're interested in this. Can I have 50 Kanos? and maybe they won't, you know, drop their jaws and stare at me just as quickly if I ask with that evidence behind me. But,
yeah. That's a big, suggestion from Richard Collato as well. So I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's formerly involved with EdTech and the US government. And I did an interview with him, and his big thing was, you know, yeah, exactly that. Don't do the big, ambitious, crazy. Don't go in big. Just start with a pilot project, prove it, and, you know, go from there. And
definitely
keep tracking and keep adapting to be on the right track.
Yeah, because I'd be lying if I didn't say that, you know, in my head, what I would have loved is to have, you know, 100 Kanos and 150 kids, and, you know, everyone would have been there. And at the end, they'd just all, like, you know, hug each other and give each other a big high five and walk away. And I'd have 150 new, you know, software engineers.
Exactly, yeah.
In the making. But, you know, yeah, you have to start with what you're capable of actually achieving, and then figure out where the potential actually is.
Cool. Well, so just to wrap up, so how was South by Southwest, and did you come away from that event with any kind of trends just for people thinking about some of the issues in the U.S. specifically?
Sure. You know, South by Southwest, this was the first year that I had had the opportunity to attend, and it was a, I'm sure there are people who have been there year after year after year, and they're probably kind of, maybe it's getting a little bit less impactful in their life, but certainly I kind of walked away from it going, oh, okay, now I'm re-energized. You know, now yeah. I have some renewed enthusiasm, and to a certain extent, that's what the purpose of these kind of conferences and gatherings is to kind of, you know, we're all kind of, throughout the year, you're kind of isolated from each other, and, you know, you're in your building and you're in your community. And maybe it feels as at times like you're kind of on your own little island. And then you go to one of these things and realize, ooh, there are a lot of people who, you know, think the things that I think are important are just as important.
That's what I was going to ask you actually as well is are you part of any, is there a sort of library system association or that is sort of a collection of your peers in what you do?
Yeah, certainly, you know, our library is kind of a member of the traditional library organizations that are out there. We have the ALA, the American Library Association, and the ALA has a bunch of sub groups. There's one for, you know, school librarians. There's one for librarians and youth services, certainly different things. In fact, I'm pretty sure that there are more than I can kind of keep track of.
Yeah.
And then of course we have things that are more designated and kind of the education sectors, but are open to people. You know, ISTE obviously is kind of one of those groups where you know, you could have a bunch of, you could definitely fill the convention center with, you know, just teachers of technology, but, you know, it's also opened up to so many different stakeholders and things like that. And, library specialists and things, but, you know, one of the things that going back to, what you were saying about South by Southwest kind of trends and things, and it sort of feels as if, and I, of course, I cannot remember her name. Maybe you have it. The founder of Little Bits.
I don't have it on the top of my head.
I can't think of it either. You know, she was one of the speakers, okay. One of the keynote speakers, and it seems as if probably the trend this coming year will be kind of a continuation of makerspaces and kind of creation. Things like that. I know that some of the most interesting sessions that I sat in on this past time were there were some people there from Finland, which of course, you know, for yeah. anyone in education, Finland is kind of the you know, the promised land.
Yeah.
You know, we sit there and we think, oh yeah, you know, that's the way. But you know, I was able to sit in on a session, Posse Salberg, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. You know, he did a great presentation on what actually makes the Finnish education system work. Mm. And, you know, that was one of the most interesting ones I sat in on, because kind of the inclination is to sit there and think, well, it's probably just because, you know, it's such a smaller country and, mm. you know, they're not as spread out. And, you know, there's this magical thing about that region of the world where, you know, kids are just born with this innate ability and, you know, all of that. Yeah. All of that is kind of like what you assume. But really, like, you know, what he was saying was it's more, they've just found kind of the perfect mix of, high quality education, instruction, you know, training their teachers, training their schools, but also fixing that gap between, you know, that equity gap, that idea that a school here is the same as a school next door and down the street and across state lines and is, you know,
yeah, that's right. Because I did an interview with a gaming company, which is mm-hmm. some of the former team that were involved in Angry Birds, and they are
from
Finland. They're launching this gaming studio called Lightnet, and Pasi, I believe, was one of their advisors. But they were talking all about, you know, the critical part of it is about inclusivity. And it's mm-hmm. absolutely essential to anyone's way of thinking sure. when they're thinking about education there, which is quite interesting.
Well, and because, you know, he was making the point that, you know, I'll use the U.S. education system because, you know, he was speaking to a bunch of people in Austin, Texas, and that was probably where the majority of people were focused. You know, he was saying that, you know, here in the United States, our downfall, where we rank lowest, is not on how we prepare teachers and things like that. You know, we're pretty kind of above average, at least in those areas. But it's that area of, we just don't have that that kind of nationwide belief that a school from one community to the next deserves to have the same, you know, opportunities and experiences as all of them, I guess. So
So final questions, just because I know you have to start your day. So you also run a podcast under the handle at EduCreators.
Yes. And, you know, just recently, podcasting has always been something I've been kind of interested in, and I've certainly listen to my fair share of podcasts. A lot. I don't have, you know, a cable subscription here, so TV, you know, is not something. I don't have TV on in the background like I was used to. You know, growing up, that was just kind of the norm. Was, you know, the TV was always on in the background, and you kind of float in and out of programs. For me now as an adult, that's become podcast. You know, I kind of almost always have a podcast on in the background.
Do you have like a top five? Any you'd like?
I could maybe get back to you. I don't know if off the top of my head I could come up with a great list. You know, there are some that I listen to purely for the entertainment portion, and then there are certainly the ones where you know, when I'm more in a I want to sit down and actually have some real thought and some real having my, you know, thinking really opened up, you know. Then there are some that I kind of float towards for that. There are some that are, you know, are just great for just listening because, you know, I live alone, and you know, you want you want kind of your friends sitting around the table with at times, and podcasting is great for that. So yeah, in the last year or so, I really kind of challenged myself to actually do some podcasting on my own, and it's very much still in the developmental phase where, you know, every once in a while I have an episode that comes out, and but my kind of focus is on finding kind of getting in on the ground floor and talking to educators, obviously starting with the ones that I have some connections with already, but just seeing, okay, what are the kind of the unique things that you're doing in your classroom? Not just, you know, how are you raising test scores, and you know, what are you doing with iPads, things like that, but actually just kind of seeing like, okay, what are some of the cool things that you're working towards? And then I have just kind of another variation of that, that's just kind of me musing about current events and education and things like that. And I kind of call that the morning announcements version of my podcast.
Okay, cool.
So for those times where I don't have an interview on hand, you know, instead I just kind of go down through kind of a list of some of the most recent headlines and just kind of talk to myself about them, talk to the listener. That is kind of the strange thing that you learn with podcasting, especially if you choose to kind of take that format of a single host kind of just talking into a microphone. It seems like it'd be very isolating because it kind of seems like, well, I'm just talking to myself. But as soon as you get a few repeat listeners, you realize like, oh no, you know, they're not sitting here directly with me right now, but you know, they're here in spirit, and pretty soon they'll be listening to this, and then we'll have kind of a dialogue, whether it's in comments or email and things like that. And so those are all the things that
that's the fun bit when people contact you and let you know they're listening in, or I listened in on the bus, or I thought this episode was really good, and you're like, oh,
definitely
this person
definitely
contacted me from Australia, or and there's a whole world out there. But okay, so that's at EduCreators, isn't it, on Twitter?
Yeah, actually that's our Twitter handle, and you can also just visit educreators.org.
Cool. And then do you have your own Twitter handle? I don't know if you have one for the library you want to let people know about.
Yeah, my kind of personal Twitter handle is Corey Roush, CoryRoush. You know, I've kind of evolved with Twitter in the last few years. For a long time, I was very active in, you know, a lot of the ed chat discussions, and it's kind of
which
almost
ones
kind
did you
of,
to take part in?
What's that?
Which ones were you a fan of when you were taking part?
You know, just you know, I can also proudly say that I was kind of in on the ground floor with Twitter pretty early on. I kind of, I've seen kind of the most basic ones. Ed chat obviously is kind of the one that's probably lasted the longest, certainly in kind of the education area. You know, and then of course you have kind of your ones that branch off of that. You know, there's an ed tech, hashtag that's
EdTech
pretty,
chat.
And probably now, you know, after I've already shared my Twitter handle, it seems as if right now what I'm tweeting about more than anything else is Big Brother.
I wanted to ask about the television series
Big Brother.
Is that what it was? Okay.
You know, here I am sitting here thinking, oh yeah, you know, share that with all of the listeners, and then, you know, the very first experience they'll have is my random musings about Big Brother. Maybe that for some of your listeners, that'll probably be a nice little overlap. They'll be like, oh, okay, yeah, I can tune in for his his occasional deep thoughts about education and technology. And then in the meantime, I'll hear about the latest gossip on Big Brother.
The equivalent here would be if you look up hashtag GBBO, so Great British Bake Off. That's
okay.
You'll find a whole rich experience of British banter, I'm sure.
And like I said, I remember being on Twitter in the early days where, you know, every tweet came to you as like a text message if you wanted it. And so I'm sitting here thinking it's a good thing we have the tools now in place where you can, you know, mute certain hashtags. And So there, I guess, would be my advice to anyone who wants to follow me on Twitter. You know, follow me. And if the Big Brother tweets get to be too much, you know, figure out how in your Twitter client to mute that hashtag, and then you'll be none the wiser.
And then the final thing, so being a literacy specialist, do you have any top reads? So I tend to put together from the interviewees, I've got about three now reading lists from various guests that we put on Goodreads. So are there any, you know, that could be in terms of education innovation, or it could just be books that have influenced you, or mm-hmm. Any that you would like to recommend to others out there?
I should have known this question was coming. Probably, and this, it would surprise me if this was the first time that one of your guests mentioned this book, but Lynchpin by Seth Godin is kind of a game changer for me. It was one of the very first books I read where I read it and thought, oh, okay, there's more here that you're capable of than kind of what you thought before. And I'm sure probably, as I say that everyone who has read Lynchpin has probably had that thought. And therefore, I don't know how unique and special each of us are. But, you know, Seth Godin would probably say that what sets you apart from everyone else who has read the book is, okay, what have you actually done then? And starting a podcast or, writing your own book or just even... Yeah, those are all kinds of things.
Just having the mindset to challenge yourself, like, what am I going to do next? I suppose not resting in and not sitting in front of the cable TV.
Sure. So you know, Lynchpin would be at the top of the list. Probably from a from like an education standpoint, reading anything that I've read so far from Jane McGonigal. Okay. Reality is Broken is probably the one that's probably the closest in terms of relation to education. But her most recent book, Super Better, has been a real personal. It's changed a lot of the ways that I've been thinking about my own personal life. It's she might not want it to be designated as a self-help book, but it certainly kind of falls into that same thinking, just of, you know, how to trick your brain into developing some resilience and some discipline and some optimism. And I think anyone, needs that at a certain point, some people more than others, but I think that's something that anyone can kind of benefit from for sure.
Definitely. I love them. Keep them coming.
I'm trying to think if there were any other, that's one of those questions where off the top of my head, you know, those are the ones that I come up with. And I'm sure if I sat down and thought of, three or four more that
do you
I will say anything.
Go for it.
I was going to say anything that Chris Guillebeau, I believe that's how you pronounce his last name. It's Guillele. I want to say Beau. he's written the Art of Nonconformity, The Happiness of Pursuit, two books that rank right up there in terms of just being real pivotal in things that I've read. So Good They Can't Ignore You is another one by Cal Newport. I'm kind of looking now at my bookshelf to help me out here. So
do you remember the first book that you read that really had an impact? So say when you're like, not the first book you read, but like maybe when you're about 12, 13, when you're like, okay, that's big. That's an influential book.
I really wish I had an answer for that. That kind of seems like something that a literacy specialist should be able to jump to and immediately say, like,
I'm kind of like, I feel I'm also kind of anti-lists because I don't think you can ever have a top one, but I think it's quite nice for others to understand.
I certainly wouldn't want any list of books to be, you know, ranked in terms of this one's better than this one. That's tricky. I guess just to kind of, boast a little bit. I just remember reading so much that now I'm sitting here thinking I really don't know what the first book that kind of changed things for me was. But I'm sure if I gave it some thought, gave it some thinking.
Well, we'll add that one. But no, that's a fantastic list. I think my challenge is I keep getting recommended all these books. I have to go off and.
Oh yes. Probably the better list to share would be the books that I want to read.
Yeah, that's true.
And certainly that list, we'd be here for another 25 minutes or so talking about just the books that, like you said, have been recommended to you and that you want to read. Well, I'll get to those someday, right?
Yeah, there's always, well, yes.
Working at a library doesn't help that either. There are certainly a lot of books where I've just brought them home at the end of the day and then been like, yeah, I'll get to that. And then they've sat there.
Yeah, you kind of have to be really disciplined about setting the time aside. But perfect. Well, I think that has brought us to the end of our conversation. We've had a mammoth hour and 15-minute podcast interview. So that's been fantastic. And so I'll share all your links in the in the show notes and everything. So I'm sure people will want to get in contact and find out more about what you're doing and what you have planned next. So, and just to check, so you in the short term, you don't have any plans to come to London?
In the short term, I do not, unfortunately. It's part of my not quite my bucket list because I hate that term, but definitely on my list of places where I want to visit, and certainly now that I've met people from Kano, If Kano, if you've got any parties coming up, I'll try and schedule.
We've got a party next week. The EdTech podcast launch party, but you have to come the next one, or maybe I'll see you.
I was going to say that might be too short of notice for right now. So
slightly expensive flights, but anyway, it's been amazing to speak to you, and let's stay in contact. And if you ever are in London, come and say hello as well.
All right. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Thank you, Corey. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.